Ki, Sri Sri Radha Madhav Ki, Sri Sri Panchatattva Bhagavan Ki, Sri Sri Pallad Narasingadev Ki, Sri Sat Goswami Prabhu Ki, Grantharaj Srimad Bhagavata Mahapurana Ki, Samaveta Bhaktivinda Ki, Sri Sat Goswami Prabhu Ki, Gaur Premanandi Hari Hari Bol, all glories to the Sum of Devotees, all glories to the Sum of Devotees, all glories to the Sum of Devotees, all glories to Sri Sri Guru and Guru, all glories to Srila Prabhupada. Namam Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutalev Shramata Bhakti Vedanta Shami Nityaname Namaste Sarasvati Devi Gauravani Vitarani Yakshish Sunyavari Vashichari Sudarani Hare Krishna. So welcome again to our next installment of the Bhagavat Science of the Mind. Is the date right? I think it's the 23rd now. Yeah, can someone kindly just change the date so that we're up to date? Got to be up to date. It's very important. And after talking with Nitai Gauranga this morning, we've come to the conclusion that it's time to kick in the afterburner. We've got to start moving through this material. We've spent a lot of time with the introduction because this is, as I've been warning you, this seminar is concerning itself with some of the most difficult parts of the Srimad Bhagavatam, the parts that devotees, when they read on their own, they generally, you know, turn the pages quite fast and get to the next leela. But we intend to go right into it, and the way the time's working out, it's doubtful that we're going to reach the end of all five essays that I wrote, but I at least want to get through the second essay. We're on the first chapter now, and there's one afterward, which is in four parts. And if we can get through that, then we will leave you with a basic and yet very complete picture of what Srimad Bhagavatam has to say about the structure of the mind, what is the conscious mind, the subconscious mind, what are things like vasanas, subconscious desires coming up, how they affect us. So much information is there from Guru Shastra Sadhu. So this is what we want to leave you with. So now we have to start burning through some material, and I feel kind of a little guilty about this because we're now going to cross over into a rather complex subject area, which is not precisely at first blush, at first glance, Bhagavata Tattva, but this is what we call Anuman. It is reasoning, worldly reasoning, which is to help us to understand the depth of Bhagavat philosophy. And this worldly reasoning is itself quite complex. So you're just going to have to bear with me. I think the best thing I do since I did write this out and rewrite it, and I do believe it's in quite clear language, that I read through this. I'll try not to read through this in a monotone voice and put you all to sleep. I'll emphasize points and maybe here and there pause just to make sure things are clear. But I think that's the fastest way we can get through this material. So you really need to tune in. And the reason, let me just preface this, that the reason we're going into this is, if you were here yesterday, you remember we were sort of left hanging with this question of the four Kumaras to Brahma, which is in the 11th canto of the Uddhava Gita. So the four Kumaras, they're going to their father, who's the creator of the universe, with this doubt. They're liberationists. And their understanding of liberation is that the mind should become free from attachment, mind should become free from its absorption in sense object. But they've realized something about the mind. You know, and I mentioned yesterday about that Gita, Dieto Vishayam Pungsang Sangateshu Pajayate, one of the first verses we all learn in Bhakti class, that if you contemplate the object of the senses, the mind becomes attached. So then the conclusion that we come to is, alright, we shouldn't contemplate the objects of the senses. But this is very interesting, because what the four Kumaras are doing here is they're finding a problem with that. They're finding on a deeper level of our philosophy a problem, an inconsistency. In that, according to their investigation, of course, these four Kumaras, they look like little boys, but they're millions of years old. They're extremely wise. They travel all around the universe. Even they can enter Vaikuntha. They discuss things with Lord Shiva, Narada Muni, Sankarshan at the bottom of the universe. It is said the Kumaras are very expert in posing questions. That's what they like to do. They like to, you know, like in some temples there are these devotees. It seems like their whole reason for living is waiting for a sannyasi to show up so they can ask a real brain-buster question that they've been nursing for months. And, you know, they just want to see if they can knock this Maharaj back with their... So the four Kumaras are really, really formidable question askers, and we're going to actually...
Do we want to open with questions, or are we going to forward with questions? Do we want to open with questions?
Do we want to open with questions? I don't want to open with questions today. I want to get through this material. That's normally what we do, is we open with questions, but we just got to move ahead. So, so the four Kumaras have asked this question, that if the point is to separate the mind from the sense objects, and in this way gain liberation, then why is the mind defined by its sense perceptions? Why is the mind so pervaded in the form of desire with sense objects? And simultaneously, why is it you can't perceive sense objects without the mind? So in other words, they're made for each other. They're a unit. Senses and mind form a unit. And the Kumaras are saying to their father, the very thought of dividing them is actually incomprehensible. As we said, what kind of mind would you, can you imagine someone who would be born with no faculty for any kind of sense perception whatsoever? You know, not even the sense of touch. He's blind, he's deaf, he can't smell, he can't hear anything. We already mentioned that, deaf. But he can't taste anything. You see? Zero. What kind of mind would he have? Could we call that a mind? Because the mind's business, as I said, it's the center of ras, the center of taste, the center of taste and desire. What kind of mind would it be? If it was a mind, it'd be in a very crippled state. So this is their essence of the question. This is the essence of their question. The whole point of gaining liberation is to detach the mind from the sense of how is it possible? So now this, what I want to do now is to go into why this is such a problem. We've already touched on this in other ways about, yes, how the world we live in is really the world of the mind. You see? This is one of the greatest, in mundane philosophy, one of the great questions. Where do you draw the line between subjectivity and objectivity? You know, where do our subjective perceptions of things end and the external reality as it is begin? And that's one of the big questions that is always argued about in philosophy, and I've read an awful lot of philosophy in my time, and I can tell you there is no clear answer, and science similarly gives no clear answer. And now we're going to find out why science gives no clear answer just now when we get into complementarity. The whole purpose of bringing up this complementarity, how many have ever heard this word before? Raise your hand. Anyone heard the word complementarity? And if you've heard, yes, you've heard it. And do you have some idea where it comes from? Just the subject matter out of which it comes? It just very generally.
Similarity?
No. Not, at least not in the sense I'm talking about. See, this is one of the problems here, is that we're talking about something that's pretty much very often outside of the realm of the discussion of devotees. You see, so, but we got to charge through this, so my apologies to you. I'm going to try to make it as easy as I can, but I warn you, it's not easy. But I hope you can catch something, enough out of it, to just see why this question the Kumaras are asking Brahma is so difficult to answer. So, as I said, I think the best thing is I just read what I wrote. So, allow me, my dear hearer, to observe that the question the four Kumaras, of the four Kumaras is about the principle of complementarity in attachment mechanics. Wow. What does that mean? Yes, what do I mean to indicate by using such cumbersome terminology? My hope is that you may better appreciate that the question the Kumaras pose to their father is capable of baffling even the greatest intelligence in the universe, which is Brahmaji himself. Thus, the problem of the relationship of the mind and sense objects can be compared to the principle of complementarity in quantum mechanics, which is where this term comes from, quantum mechanics or quantum physics, which baffles the greatest minds among our present-day scientists. So now, I ask the reader to kindly indulge me while I take a few moments to try to make the above paragraph as clear as I can. So, there is a system of mechanics. Now, you all know what mechanics is, right? I mean, there are car mechanics, there are refrigerator mechanics, right? So we're talking about mechanics. But there is a system of mechanics that is supposed to operate in the micro world, which means the world at the atomic and subatomic level. The world beyond our power to see because it's so small. It's smaller than the length of the wave of light. So with optical microscopes, you know, with glass lenses, you can see certain larger molecules, but it is impossible to see an atom with a glass optic microscope. You need an electron microscope, and then what you get is some electromagnetically generated image, which they tell you is an atom. But I talked to one nuclear physicist, and he said, to tell the truth, we don't really know if it's an atom or not. It's just an image on a CRT screen. Means it's like a TV screen that we get, and we call it an atom, but we don't. You know, we don't, because that's an indirect image. We don't know really what it is. You know. But anyway, it's impossible for us to see an atom. That's also what the Bhagavatam says. So scientists call this system of mechanics quantum or wave mechanics. And the whole system is based on duality that is observed in, for instance, radiant phenomena like light. Light is radiant. It radiates out from the sun. Everyone with me? Yeah? I'm not losing anyone. So experiments show that photons, which are the subatomic units of light, see, light is composed, according to science, of very, very tiny units. Notice I didn't say particles. I said units. Because we're going to find out why you can't really call them particles. So we're just calling them units for now. And these subatomic units of light behave either as waves, you know, like waves of water, or when sound moves through air, it also creates a wave. Sometimes light seems to behave like waves, or sometimes it behaves like particles. So that's a duality, because waves are not particles, and particles are not waves. So, and whether they behave as waves of particle depends on circumstances. In 1927, the Danish, we have a descendant of the great Danish nation with us, Dr. Fries from Denver. So the Danish physicist, he's very well famous, Niels Bohr, he put forward a principle derived from these experiments, because the 20s was really the era of the blooming of quantum mechanics. And since that time, quantum mechanics has not theoretically made much progress. See, it just sort of flourished in the 20s and the 30s. They built the atom bomb in the 40s as a result of it. And they've not really gone that much farther because of the limits of our sense perception and our technology. You see? So pretty much the fundamentals of quantum mechanics that were established in the 20s, they've been dressed up a bit and refined a bit since then, but pretty much they're still in place as they were. So he put forward a principle of complementarity, which is still in the field of quantum physics, is still pretty much the law, pretty much the accepted explanation of things. It's pretty much the theory that most scientists will go with. There are other attempts, but they're nowhere near as influential as this one. And this is the principle of complementarity. So what does it argue? It argues that what we call the wave aspect of photons appears out of our ignorance of the simultaneous particle aspect. The opposite is true as well. The particle aspect appears within our state of ignorance about the simultaneous wave aspect. Thus, a photon is called a wave particle, wave-particle. That's what photons and all these subatomic particles, they're called wave particles, because they have both aspects. Because the two aspects are complementary. They complement one another. Since scientists are unable to observe a photon as a wave and a particle at the same time, and they've done many, many, many experiments since the 1920s up to the present day, they've, gotten much more sophisticated technological apparatus. These, like in Geneva in Switzerland, they have this, it's called CERN. It's a, what they used to call a cyclotron. It's an atom smasher. It goes all the way around Lake Geneva. It's 4 kilometers in diameter. Big ring, big metal tube. And they send these particles around and around and around, faster, 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 powered by magnetic attraction. And then finally they smash into each other. And then they got instruments that read what's happened. So they have been trying all kinds of experiments to break through this barrier and finally see a photon or a meson or neutron or electron as a complete unit rather than either as a wave or as a particle. And they've not been able to do it to this very day. So, since they're unable to do it, the sometimes wave aspect and the sometimes particle aspect complement one another to form a more complete, and I put in italics, theory of what a photon is like. I stress the word theory because what scientists do observe, photon as wave and photon as particle, exist only as experimental models. Models that are not only incomplete but mutually contradictory. Since they contradict one another, they do not add up to be a concrete whole. Thus, a wave particle is not a quote-unquote real thing, like a pebble or an orange. But since pebbles and oranges are ultimately made up of wave particles, that's the point that was raised in that film that we saw. You see, you break matter down and finally, or you raise the point, quoting Owen Barfield, what's the difference between a tree and a rainbow ultimately? See, you can see a tree, you can see a rainbow, Now, we say there's a difference because, well, I can walk up to a tree and I can touch it, but I can't walk up to a rainbow and touch it. But ultimately, they tell you, the scientists tell you, well, a tree is made up of these wave particles and, you know, these are separated by vast, vast, vast distances of space. I mean, if you were able to reduce yourself down to what, to the size of a, you know, a photon, it'd be like lost in space. Wasn't there some TV serial, or you seem to remember, years ago, Lost in Space? You'd be lost in, you know, just an ocean of space, and then somewhere out there zipping around long, long distance away would be one photon in a stream of light. You might detect it on your, you know, your intergalactic radar sensor. Whoa, one photon just went by. You know, 10 million parsecs away from here. I mean, these things are separated by such vast distances that practically solid matter disappears. And so that's what scientists tell us what a tree ultimately is. So in that sense, then a tree is really no more substantial than a rainbow. You see? You come to this point where all sense objects just become illusions. And that's what we call Maya, right? So you see, I hope you've been able to follow this so far, because what we're doing is we're staring now into the abyss of the material energy, the abyss of illusion, the abyss of Maya. What Maya is throwing at us, and why it is so difficult to understand, impossible to understand, actually. Even the greatest minds of the universe cannot understand it. So, a wave particle is not a real thing like a pebble or an orange, yet light is a quote-unquote real thing. Otherwise, you know, how could we be sitting here and seeing one another? How could I read this page if it wasn't for the sun behind me casting this light? And yet, remember again in the film, we've never really seen light, you see? These baffling things. We're always faced with these baffling contradictions, you know, things that, facts that contradict our everyday experience. Here we are, bathed in light, feeling the light of the sun, and yet scientifically speaking, none of us have ever seen light. So I'm not going to re-explain that point. It was in the film and we talked about it. And light, so light is a supposed real thing, and light appears to be made up of wave particles. Of course this state of affairs is baffling. Thus Niels Bohr concluded that the study of physics reveals only, this is a very important quote, it reveals only what we can say about nature, not how nature actually is. Physics, this science, which is considered to be, you know, physics is like the bedrock of all science. You know, like psychology, our dear Nitai Gauranga is trained in psychology. Well, you know, in the realm of science, psychologists are like duffers, you know. Like, oh, you're a psychologist, oh, okay, you know. If there's a general scientific convention and different kinds of scientists come, then the psychologists are sort of, you know, they're relegated to this corner, you know, where the more hardcore dealing with matter scientists are kind of, you know, like, look at those psychologists standing over there. What do they do anyway? I mean, they get paid so much money. What do they really do? I mean, here we are, we're dealing with spectral analysis, and we're dealing with heavy metals, and we're dealing with, you know, new strides and electrodynamics, and these guys are just, you know, wandering around in the mental plane and, you know, constructing all these crazy theories that can't actually be proved, you know. And so there's a hierarchy of scientists, actually. And what it finally comes down to is physics. Especially since the 19th century, it's kind of prejudice left over from the 19th century, because before Einstein, the physicists thought they really had the material world all figured out. They had all their mechanical laws in place, everything was explained, And then Einstein came along with his relativity theory and blew everything out of the water. And then 15 years later came quantum mechanics, which, I mean, maybe the pieces were starting to come back down. You know, they were blown out of the water by relativity, but then there was another explosion that blew them right out of orbit. You know? And now it's like way out in outer space. So, but still, physics, you know. The solid stuff of reality, if you're a materialist. That's where it's at. Someone who's able to study that, that's a real scientist. There's one physicist, Eddington, I think his name, one of the leading early physicists, and he said, I think he made the comment that real science means physics, everything else is stamp collecting. You see, because this is where you're dealing with the real solid stuff, and so you can imagine where a guy like that would put psychology, you know, way, just way out there, you know, just... Never mind, you know, don't waste your time with it. But physicists, it turns out, are baffled. Because each side of the wave-particle duality reflects an ignorance of the other. Why light appears at sometimes to be formed of particles, while at the other time it appears to be formed of waves, is not known. It's not known. There is no explanation for it. It would seem that some deeper principle determines the appearance of light as particles or light as waves. But that deeper principle is hidden from science. And so it follows that light, as much as science understands it, exists in mental speculation. Hmm? You see what I've just said? We've just explained how psychology is relegated to the, you know, the edge of the cocktail. You were talking about the cocktail party phenomena. So, among scientific cocktail parties, the physicists are at the the psychologists are at the edge. But here, we see that actually the physicists are in the same boat. And this one physicist I spoke with at length in Finland, in the city of Tampere in Finland, at the university there, he told me as much. He said ultimately, quantum physics comes down to one thing, and that is mathematics. It's pure mathematics. Where does mathematics exist? Anyone care to let us know? In the mind, yeah. So physics is supposed to be about this, but it ultimately ends up about this. See? And it's baffling. Especially if you're, you know, one of these type of persons who wants to, you know, who needs to have, you know, solid objects that you can hang on to. This is reality. This is reality. And then you've got these physicists who are supposed to be the scientists of real reality telling you, well, you know, it may just be mind. Oh my God.
You know, like psychologists.
I better go see a psychologist. So, what light is a theory, not a fundamental truth or reality. By keeping in mind this perspective on the speculative nature of scientific so-called, you know, in quotes, knowledge, we gain valuable insight into a translation of the Yasyasti Bhaktir Bhagavatya Kinchana verse, which is Srimad Bhagavatam 5.18.12, that Srila Prabhupada presents in more than one place, and he often quotes this in his purports. So the translation is, one who has unflinching devotional faith in Krishna consistently manifests all the good qualities of Krishna and the demigods. However, he who has no devotion to the Supreme Personality of Godhead has no good qualifications. Kuto Mahadguna. He does not have, Mahadguna means good qualities. Why? Because he is engaged in mental concoction in material existence, which is the external feature of the Lord. Now, a person lacking devotion to Krishna can have no knowledge of him. That's the meaning of Bhagavad Gita 18.55. In the absence of knowledge of Krishna, who is has a name, this beautiful name, Jagat Dadhara, which means the deep, unchanging reality upon which the transitory cosmos is established. You see? means underneath matter, you know, underneath this physical matter. Then we come to the subtle realm which is indistinguishable from mind. See, even in physics, we come to a realm where does the mind end and physics begin? And the scientists can't answer clearly. So underneath all that, there is Lord Jagadhara. Jagad means the universe, Dhara means he who holds, supports. So the actual support of all phenomena is Krishna himself. So this is that state of consciousness in which there is no knowledge, no real knowledge of anything, only theories, is the state called Manoratha, riding on the chariot of the mind. Manoratha. One is just riding on the mental chariot. And that means if you're on the mental platform, then you can be, you know, like in American slang, maybe it's everywhere now because American slang spreads quickly, but we have this term jerk. It refers to a guy who's, you know, not very bright. Now, there is actually, interestingly, a kind of funny etymological origin to this term. You know, why jerk? Because the word jerk means to pull on something suddenly, violently, you know? Like, it's a verb actually, in the proper use. If you see a child wandering into the road and a car is coming and there's a threat that the child will be hit by the car, then you reach out and you jerk the child out of the way of the car, you see? Just without caring for the child's composure of mind, because this is more serious. You just yank. That's a synonym, yank or jerk. Pull swiftly, suddenly. Maybe the child's going to cry because it was such a shock to be pulled, but it would be a much greater shock if the child is hit by a car. So, how did this term jerk, which is a verb, get used for a person? It means a person who is too easily jerked out of his position. You know, in other words, it's like, well, when I was a kid, there was this insane comedian named Jerry Lewis. He always played the archetypical, you use the word archetypical. So he was the archetypical jerk. In other words, he'd show up all dressed up in a nice suit and his hair combed. And, you know, you'd think he's a normal guy, you know, walk into a party or some social situation. But as soon as he starts to interact with people, he's a jerk, you know. I mean, his activities, his way of speaking, his way of doing things, everything he does just jerks him out of that image of being a normal person. And everyone's kind of like, Charlie Chaplin used to, maybe he's more classical, Charlie Chaplin used to often play this type of character. You see, the first, as he walks in, everyone's, oh, here's another guest at our party. But, you know, then he starts doing all these weird things, and by his activities, he's jerked out of that image, and everyone realizes, this is a jerk. You know, this is, he doesn't belong here. Where did this guy come from? You know, what's he doing here? He's just disturbing the whole atmosphere. So a person who's situated on the mental platform is then easily, very easily jerked by Maya out of his position. You see? Because that's the nature of the mind. It's chanchala. It's unsteady. So if all of our knowledge, all of our qualities, all of our conceptions of what the world is and our place in the world is all situated on the mind, then we're jerks. And that's what happens also in these scientific revolutions. Also, when I was a kid, there was a book written by Thomas Kuhn, which was it had a lot to do, I think, with the, it was one of the great impetuses for the hippie movement, actually. Because I think it was published in 1959 or 1960, and it was called, I think the proper title was The Theory of Revolution, The Theory of Scientific Revolution, something like that. And Thomas Kuhn was writing that there, you know, as far as human knowledge goes, we can't really say that anything is an ultimate fact, an ultimate truth. what happens is that in history, just certain ideas become prominent and become accepted socially by everyone that this is the way things are. And he goes back to Aristotle, who is considered in the West the first scientist. But Aristotle had all kinds of wacky ideas. He was the first, let us say, Kali Yuga scientist to really, prepare like an encyclopedic division of physical reality into so many categories, resembling like biology and geology and so on and so forth, these different subjects. He was trying to categorize knowledge. But at the same time, like one of the things he said was, and this was, Aristotelian science was just embraced by the Catholic Church. This is what's very interesting. It was embraced by the Catholic Church. And they had this term, I don't remember the Latin right now, but knowledge meant either the affairs of the church or the affairs of the philosopher. The philosopher was Aristotle. I wish I could remember. I'd have to look them up, the Latin terms. So, in other words, life, proper living, consists of these two things. The doctrine of the church combined with what the philosopher, they would just use this word, the philosopher has said. And everyone knows, they mean this one philosopher, Aristotle, you see. But this, the philosopher, for example, he said in his book on anatomy, that men have more teeth than women. Now what kind of science is that? And Aristotle had two wives. He never thought of asking one of his wives to open her mouth so he could count her teeth. Then he would have discovered that men and women have the same number of teeth. So there's all these wacky things in this. But anyway, he was the first scientist. So Thomas Kuhn went back to that and said, for that time, that civilization, Aristotelian physics, science, was as valid as our science is today. Because in our science today, there are also so many holes, there are also so many gaps. There are also the equivalents to, men having more teeth than women right now, like the theory of evolution. Now we in ISKCON, of course, being devotees, all right, we're all rah, 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 evolution is bunk. Charles Darwin is one of the three greatest demons. But actually, outside of ISKCON too, evolution is getting in hotter and hotter water every day. And now there's a new big attack against evolution, which is called the theory of design. It's not creationism. Creationism is these fundamental Bible thumpers who try to, take the biblical account of creation and make it look scientific. So they had some success, but ultimately, because their source of evidence was the Bible, they didn't go that far. But now there's a very serious scientific movement, which is design theory. And they profess no faith. They don't talk about God, but they just say that there is intelligent design and it cannot be denied, and they have very sophisticated proofs of it. And they just say things couldn't exist if there wasn't intelligence. And this goes back to Plato. Plato made a very simple argument. He said, in my body there's earth, out in the great universe there's earth, in my body there's water, out in the great universe there's water, in my body there's air and fire, out in the great universe there's air and fire, in my body there's intelligence. Why shouldn't there be intelligence out there? Why does it suddenly stop? Oh yes, there's earth, water, fire and air in your body and in the universe. But there's only intelligence in your body and not in the universe. He said, what kind of logic is that? It's a simple point. Very simple. And so these design theorists are doing very deep studies of this and showing how things could not be without intelligent design. It just couldn't exist. Just mathematically impossible. And I hope to get for our library, I hope I still have it. I have about 100 kilos of books on a ship, on two ships actually on the way. One of them a book by Dr. Fred Hoyle, one of the leading physicists. He wrote a book called The Intelligent Universe, which is really an eye-opener because it very scientifically smashes evolution and all these things. So anyway, getting back to the main point. Yes, I was talking about Thomas Kuhn. So he was saying modern science is just a bunch of theories strung together. And they work. So in the ancient world, Aristotle's physics and biology and so on, it worked for that time. For the level, for that civilization, it worked. It was okay. They could use it for practical ends. And then he shows in history how, because in science there's always new discoveries being made which disprove the old theories, so there becomes like an imbalance, you know. The new discoveries start to disbalance the old theories, and gradually, then suddenly there's a revolution, there's a flip. And there comes a new generation of thinkers who say, you know, Aristotle, that's what happened when Galileo started looking, that's famous, you know. You probably all remember that in school. Because the Catholic Church enshrined Aristotle, so he was king for 1,000 years or more. He was king, but then Galileo got this telescope, which was about the size of a cigar, and started looking out into outer space and seeing things that were totally contradictory to what Aristotle said should be there, and he was brave enough to announced them to the world, and the Catholic Church told him to shut up. So he did shut up, but still the word got out, and then others started to pick up on it. Some of them got burned at the stake, but some of them, like Copernicus, a Polish astronomer, then he took the discoveries of Galileo and he developed into the heliocentric theory that all the planets are revolving around the sun instead of everything revolving around the earth. So that was a big revolution. A big revolution that changed so much in science. And so there have been these revolutions. When they discovered electrical energy, the electric fields, Faraday and Maxwell, that was another rather major revolution. And then Einstein, big revolution. Then quantum physics, big, big revolution. So these revolutions happen. Why do they happen? They're changes of mind. That's what they are. They're changes of mind. That's what's happening. So the conclusion is that a person who is so situated in mental concoction can have no lasting good qualities. In other words, you see, if everything, our whole conception of the world, of what we are, who we are, like Darwinism, you know, Darwinism, you learn that in school, and it seems they teach it with such conviction, and it seems like such an innocent theory, you know. Like, what's wrong with it? It seems to make sense, and what's the harm of it? But, well, there was this one outgrowth of Darwinism, which is very embarrassing to the Darwinists, called social Darwinism. Social Darwin, the social application of Darwinism. Which is what the scientists, the early scientists who, you know, became the, you know, Darwin's, you know, dogs. I mean, the barking dogs of Charles Darwin, the scientists who went out there growling, Darwin, Darwin, history is right, ruff, ruff, ruff. And if you've got anything to say against it, I'm going to bite you. You see, there was this one, Thomas Haeckel, he was a German. He was known as Darwin's bulldog. He used to just travel the world preaching Darwinism. And the scientists, you know, they have an agenda too. They're not just ivory tower intellectuals. They have a vision of the world. They're demons for the most part. And they have a scientific view of the world, and they have scientific values that they want everyone to swallow. They want everyone to think that we're just matter. They want everyone to give up the idea of any idea of soul or God. They want everyone to live as the most advanced animal. You know? The ape with the brain. That's how we should see ourselves. That's what many scientists, they have that agenda. So they want to change society. So one of the outcomes of Darwinism was this phenomenon called social Darwinism. And out of social Darwinism came communism. All glories to communism. All glories to the gulag. To the millions of people who died in Siberia. This was the result of social Darwinism. Society has to change. Survival of the fittest. You become a communist. If you can't become a communist, then you die. You don't deserve to live. And another form of social Darwinism was National Socialism, Nazism. The same thing. If you're an Aryan, then you're the most evolved human being. If you're Jewish or Gypsy or dark-skinned or whatever, then you're a subhuman and should be sent off to the camps and up the chimney. You see? In the form of smoke. We don't need you. You're just a burden on the, you know, superior human beings. So these, you can see the very terrible results of this buying into science. You see? So this is a good illustration of, if one is on the mental platform, there are actually no good qualities. Because it just takes a scientific revolution, and suddenly overnight, what everyone was thinking was good becomes bad. And what everyone was thinking bad is now good. It's like Freud also. Before Freud was the Victorian era. In the Victorian era, that's a famous time, in, say the second half of the 1800s, I think, the reign of Queen Victoria. So, if you go back, if you study back at that time, a lot of people were advocating celibacy. They were very down on illicit sex. People should be moral. People should, you know, men and women should not mix freely. Women should be chaste and wear long dresses, even in Europe, you see. And then very strong imposition of these values in Western society. Then Freud came along. He published his first book, I think his first influential book was about 1899, just at the end of the century, The Interpretation of Dreams. And then he started publishing other books. So that was the end of the Victorian era. And he started talking about how we're all artificially repressing our sex desire, and because of that we're all getting screwed up with neuroses and psychoses and this and that, the other thing. And although, as we said, it may not have been Freud's actual intention, but the demons really jumped on this. So, you know, demons meaning asura, and it's defined actually, asu, this life, ra, ramyate, they want to enjoy this life. Those who just want to enjoy this life, they jumped on that. Great news! We're all screwed up because we're not having enough sex. Thank you, Sigmund Freud. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. Hurrah for Sigmund Freud. He's freed us from archaic moralities. Now we can have as much sex as we want, and it's healthy and it's good. It'll free us, it'll liberate us. Great. You see? So, overnight, and this literally was an overnight revolution. You know, it just took maybe 2 decades. Overnight, from this Victorian rigidity, you know, very strict moral principles. Anyone who would deviate from them would become a social embarrassment, you know, would be ostracized. And then suddenly you get the roaring 20s, you know. The Victorian era began, so let's say it ended around 1900, 20 years later, after the First World War. The roaring 20s. Now, I've done a little study into history. I grew up in the 60s, you know, which was also a wild time, but it seems like the 60s were nothing compared to the 20s. 1920s was. There you had, in America, prohibition. And that simply fueled the rise of gangsterism, the mafia. The mafia became so powerful. You had women's liberation, these women walking around in the first mini skirts with these little metal flasks of whiskey stuck into their hose, their pantyhose, the wear on their legs, just stuck on their garter in here. And they just reach under their dress and pull it out, open up, drink right on the street. Real wild times, the jazz era, this music, this wild music. Wild music that people do crazy dances to have now been around for a good, 50, 60, 70 years. But the Roaring Twenties was when it all started. All these crazy dances like the Charleston and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. People just throwing their arms and legs around and bopping their heads all over the place. Going nuts and being intoxicated all the time and having illicit sex anytime, any place, and women dressing in shorter and shorter, as little as possible. You see, we call such women morons with less on. So, because they have nothing upstairs. Moron is a person with not much upstairs, not much on the body. So, all this started in the 20s. As a result of these trends, Darwinism, Freudianism, Marxism, all these movements of liberation. And Prabhupada grew up during that time, and that's why he identified these three as the three greatest demons, because all this burst out. You can imagine Srila Prabhupada being born in a Vaishnav family as a little boy doing Jagannath festival. You see Radha Krishna deities, his father being a pure devotee, and then seeing all this, because it came to India too, because the British were running India. So all this suddenly was here too. So what a shock. So this is the meaning of that. That if you're situated on the mental platform, there actually are no good qualities. Because they'll just be, like Thomas Kuhn said, this periodically a revolution of scientific understanding, and everything you believed suddenly becomes obsolete, and there's a whole new theory of reality, and along with that, a whole new morality. You see? Now it's okay. Now it's okay. I remember when I was on Sankirtan, we sometimes, in America, they got these drive-in theaters, these big car parks, and there's a big cinema screen in front, and you can hang a speaker on your, roll down your window a little bit and hang a speaker inside, and you watch a movie inside your car. So sometimes on our Sankirtan party, we used to go to these drive-in cinemas, and we just go car to car, knock on the door, and sell some, incense or something. And so once I was, we didn't do this very much because it's not really good for brahmacharis, but in those cars, one can often stumble across some very unsavory activities going on. But once in a while, we would do that. And so there was one time I remember, I just kept looking at the screen because the movie was so interesting. It was a movie called Soylent Green. And I was wondering, because it was set in the future, and the future that was being portrayed, what attracted me was so much like the future of Kali Yuga, depicted in Srila Prabhupada's books. I don't know if anyone of you know have ever heard of this film, so it came out in the 70s. You're old enough to know it. You saw it recently, huh? Anyway, so it turns out that Soylent Green, it's produced by the Soylent Corporation, because all the food, all the natural food on the planet has been used up, just like it's predicted in the Bhagavatam. The ground is arid, no longer grows crops, so what to do for food? So this corporation called Soylent Corporation, which is apparently mining the sea for algae and turning that into wafers, green wafers. And so they're selling green wafers of two varieties, Soylent Red and Soylent Green. And this is what people eat. And things like strawberry jam, you know, this is for the elite of the elite. Only, you know, really rich people, they have a special stock of strawberry jam and olives and, you know, grown, I guess, in greenhouses and exotic places. And they're very expensive. But the general mass, and the world is overpopulated, and they're all shudras and living in, you know, these dilapidated apartment buildings. Really, that's what interested me. It seemed like a pretty accurate look into the future. And then at the end of the film, you find out that the Soylent Corporation, they weren't actually successful in turning this algae into food. So the corporation had another job, and that was disposing of the dead bodies, because many people were dying. And so they were just taking dead human bodies and turning it into these wafers called Soylent Green, and everyone was living, eating dead human bodies. And then I thought, wow, you know, somebody's either reading Prabhupada's books or really in tune with the super soul. Because that's how Kali Yuga is supposed to end up. So you see, that's what I mean about the change of time, the change of values. If you're simply on the mental plane, then one day it may be just okay to eat Soylent Green, you know. Hello, Grandpa! Crunch! Prabhupada actually talked about primitive tribes where when the old people become useless, then they're put in the pot and cooked. Grandpa's put in the pot. He actually mentioned it in one lecture. So we're coming to that. So, another Bhagavatam verse, 8.5.8, declares, Vastu Vedaha Ajanantas. Only due to ignorance do people concoct dualities and differences. Whether it is a wave particle duality or the mind sense objects duality, duality is a function of mental concoction, not of reality itself.
Can you repeat the number?
The verse is 8.5.8. Mental concoction, in turn, is a function of ignorance. That's admitted by the complementary theory of Niels Bohr. That we see a photon as a wave because we're in, at that time we're in ignorance of its aspect as a particle. We see it as a particle because at that moment we're in ignorance of its aspect as, of a wave. In other words, ignorance is dominating the situation. And that's exactly what the Bhagavatam says. And that's why I went through this arduous explanation of the theory of complementarity, just to hopefully make it very clear to you why this is such a deep subject matter, why it is so baffling. It baffles all the scientists today. You see, if you read these books on quantum physics, I've read many of them, and they all come to, they just say it's a paradox. We don't know, we don't understand, we can't explain. Another paradox of quantum physics is that the micro world, why is it holding together? Because everything is random. You see? Everything, these photons, neutrons, electrons, their interactions are all random. It's all happening by chance. So why does this remain a pillar? You see? Why is it a pillar? They have no explanation for that. Why doesn't it become an elephant in the next second? Why doesn't it become a Saturn IV rocket ship? Why doesn't it become a Maserati sports car? Why doesn't it become a little tabby cat? Why doesn't it become a Brontosaurus? Why doesn't it become a mountain? Why doesn't it become something else? Anything. From second to second. Why do objects retain their form? They have no explanation for that. Therefore, some of them propose, the more intelligent one propose, we have to add the factor of consciousness. And then quantum mechanics becomes very interesting when these theorists start to talk, because they say the world is appearing as it is because of the way we're looking at it. And matter itself is taking shape because consciousness is interacting with it on a certain level. And this is what the Bhagavatam is saying too. So some of the more intelligent quantum physicists propose such ideas. It's not that I can say that this is broadly accepted across the spectrum, because quantum mechanics, again, that word mechanics, I once read in one book written by one of these kind of quantum physicists who does advocate that we introduce consciousness into the calculations. He said, look, he wrote frankly, he said, you know, quantum mechanics, they're mechanics. In other words, they're most of them do not think any more about philosophical questions than car mechanics do. You see, they just use quantum mechanics to produce new forms of technology. They just use it for a purpose. And they're not really interested in these philosophical questions. Only a few are. But those few who do, like Eugene Wigner and some others, they are considered the most intelligent, really the most intelligent leading theorists. One of them, John Wheeler, an American, he was the one who said, it's time, I think he said this in the 1960s or 70s, it's time to stop thinking of the universe as a big machine and start to think of it as a great thought. You see? That's getting close to the Bhagavata conception of what's really going on. Because we know, where does everything, these forms ultimately come from? There's a gigantic manifestation Lord known as Mahavishnu, who's in Yoga Nidra. He's dreaming, and his dreams, in other words, his thoughts, that's what they are, right out there. What we call reality are the dreams of the Lord. So some quantum physicists, by their probing into the ultimately illusory nature of so-called physical matter and their confrontation with the mind, how much the mind has to do with perception, even on the level of, you know, subatomic matter, whether it's wave or particle, the mind is involved. This is the conclusion that we're dealing with consciousness ultimately. And there is some consciousness other than ours, which is maintaining the standard. That's why this pillar remains a pillar. Because I'm not always looking at them. When I'm looking at you, I'm not looking at the pillar. So this pillar, you know, might be turning into some kind of monster behind my back, you know, reaching its claws around my neck, and then I look back and it's a pillar. It's a pillar again, you know. But no, there's someone else who is looking at this material nature. Sa'akshita, the Vedas say. The Lord is looking, and therefore it takes this form. And the Lord is the maintainer. Lord Vishnu is the maintainer. So the physical world is maintaining its shape only because of his glance. So kindly allow me to make one more point in this regard, and I think you're going to find this mind-blowing. At least I hope you do. Sometimes scientists, the more intelligent ones, propose that the wave particle is all we know of a higher dimensional state that is intruding into our lower dimensional awareness. A thought experiment is given as an illustration. This is a thought experiment which comes from science. I read this in a book on science, and it's very interesting. So you set up two video cameras to view an aquarium with a single large fish in it. Focus one camera on the front of the aquarium and train the other to view the side of it, one side of it. Connect each camera to one of two monitors positioned side by side in another room. So if you're in the other room only able to see the video monitors, that one fish will always look like two fish when observed through the two monitors. This is because the fish itself exists in three dimensions, but the monitors are only able to show us two dimensions. Whenever in one monitor we see the front of the face of the fish, in the other we see its side. You understand what I'm saying? So they look completely different. And so it may be with the wave particle also. As we shall learn shortly from Srimad Bhagavatam, this is precisely the case with the dualism of mind and sense objects. It is of a higher order of reality than we are able to grasp. You see? This duality of mind and sense objects is, we are confronting something of a higher order of reality, higher dimension, and therefore we're in duality. Was that clear to everyone? No? What didn't you understand?
Is this because of this voice?
Oh, you can't hear. Well, I'm sorry about that. I heard that they're digging a big hole in the ground, and nobody in Mayapur management can explain why they're doing that. That was the information. I asked about that. I asked Sadbuj Prabhu, who's my friend, who's in charge of the Mayapur project, and he said, I don't know what they're doing. They're digging a big hole in the ground. It wasn't my idea, so. Huh? Yeah, but it's not really within the plan that's been made, so. Yeah, so somehow. Anyway, someone is paying them to dig that hole, and we're suffering as a result. That's all I know. So, I'll just repeat quickly. The example of the fish, did you hear that? Yes. So, if you look at these two monitors, you see what appears to be two different fish. You're seeing the fish, the face of the fish looking at you in one monitor, and then you're seeing the side of the fish in the other monitor. And it looks like two different fish. But it is only one fish that is existing in three dimensions. You understand? One fish has length, breadth, and height, you see. But the monitor is only able to show you the height and the length, not the depth. So therefore, it looks like two things. So, now imagine that there is a fourth dimension beyond three dimensions. And the fourth dimension intrudes on our three dimensions, and therefore we're seeing the same things as either a wave or a particle. It's the same exact thing, but we always see it different because we do not have the sensory equipment to perceive in four dimensions. Understand? Yes. So this is very important. I really wanted to. This is a very key element to understanding everything that's going to follow in this course as far as we go. So, now, let us return to Sri Krishna's narrative about the question put by the Kumaras to their father Brahma. My dear Uddhava, the Lord said in text 18 to his friend and devotee, Brahma himself, who is born directly from the body of the Lord, and who is the creator of all living entities within the material world, being the best of the demigods, seriously contemplated the question of his sons headed by Sanaka. The intelligence of Brahma, however, was affected by his own activities of creation, and thus he could not discover the essential answer to this question. Even Brahma had no answer. Even he, because he's the creator. You see, so he's attached to this universe. His mind is attached to this universe. He's thinking, because I did it, it's real. Therefore, he gets bewildered too.
What text number is that?
What text number is that? That's text number 18. In, I gave the chapter before. From, I don't want to look back, but it's in the 11th canto. I mentioned it already, so if you've taken that note, it's following in the same chapter. Again, I must beg the reader's indulgence. As I attempt to shed the light on why Brahmaji found the question of his son so challenging, here Krishna points to Brahma's activities of creation as blocking his sight of the answer. This indicates that the structure of the universe, that is, the cosmology, cosmology means the structure of the universe, is so subtle and involving that it diverts even the creator's intelligence from the absolute truth. Brahma is as I think you know from Prabhupada's books, he is the most qualified jiva in the whole universe. Therefore, he's Brahma. He's jiva tattva, but he's chosen by the Lord to be an avatar, a Shaktivesh avatar, invested with the Raju Guna, the quality to create. That secondary creation called Visarga. The Lord's own creation is called Sarga, the secondary creation of Brahma, in which he creates the gross forms of the universe based on the Lord's subtle Hiranyagarbha manifestation of the what Plato would call the realm of pure ideas, the realm of pure forms. That's Hiranyagarbha. The pure, like this is Shodasha Kala. There are 16 aspects. And I think I told you that I once did a database search of this term, Shodasha Kala, in Srimad Bhagavatam, and it came up so many times, I just, you know, by the sixth canto, I just stopped it, because there were already nearly 100 entries by the sixth canto. So this is actually one of the most important aspects of our philosophy. The 16. The 16 means that, to borrow a word from Jung, archetypes. There are archetypical five senses of knowledge, like the eye and the ear. There's archetypical five senses of action, like the hand and the leg. There are archetypical five sense objects, what you see, what you hear, what you touch. And there's an archetypical mind, which includes archetypical intelligence and archetypical ego. So this is existing in the Hiranyagarbha manifestation, which is equivalent to, in the Vyuhas, the chapter of Vyuhas, which we'll be explaining hopefully we'll be able to get to that, that's very important. That's the Pradyumna manifestation of the chapter of Vyuha, who appears among the Purusha avatars as Garbhodakshaya Vishnu. Garbhodakshaya Vishnu is the source of Lord Brahma. Lord Brahma meditates upon Garbhodakshaya Vishnu, visualizes his form, and from that archetypical form of the Lord, that's his blueprint of creation. So what Brahma does is creates a gross replication, just like a sculpture. You see, a sculptor, a beautiful young girl walks into his studio, she sits down, and then out of marble, he sculpts her figure. You see, that's of stone. So the gross universe is just like that. It requires artistry, great skill, but there's an original, which is even more beautiful. The original person. And who's that original person? That's Krishna. That's the Lord. In this case, an expansion of the Lord, Pradyumna or Garbhodakshaya Vishnu. So he's showing the archetypical 16, Shodasha Kala. These are the 16 constituents of a person. And they're the basis of everything in the universe. Actually, that's why we see that Virata Purusha, the form of the universe, as the Lord, as a person, personality, with, for example, the Brahmanas on the head, the Kshatriyas on the arm, or the uppermost planetary systems, Satyaloka on the head, and other planetary systems on the chest and the waist, and so on and so forth, like that. So, modern science invests much brain power in problems of cosmology. In the world of antiquity, it was no less a topic of investigation. Although then, the investigation proceeded along more Vedic lines, even in the ancient Western world. I shall now take the liberty of citing a British philosopher of mysticism named G.S.R. Mead from a book published in 1919 entitled The Doctrine of the Subtle Body in the Western Tradition. And now we're reaching 5:30. So we won't be able to go very far into this, but this is really, really interesting stuff. Because by reading, of course, this was written in 1919, the language is rather, from our perspective now in 2006, a bit cumbersome, so I try to make it easier to understand. But if you can understand what this mead is talking about, the basic concepts, then you're going to be getting a sketch, let's say a sketch, a basic sketch, a basic outline of the Bhagavata presentation of both the macrocosm, means the great cosmos outside, and the microcosm, this human body and mind. They are both interrelated. They are both, practically speaking, inseparable. You see? So this was something known, this is not just what makes